on the next case.
PHC Martinsville, Inc., Federer versus Dennis. John B. Mumford, Jr., Eileen R. Geller, John S. Buford, W. Brantley Phillips, Jr., Appellant Counsel. James W. Haspin, Scott C. Wall, Appellant Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Buford. I am counsel for the Appellant Hospital in this matter. I am pleased and proud to introduce to you Mr. Brant Phillips of the Tennessee Bar, who has been admitted pro hoc vice and who will present the argument for the hospital.
All right, Mr. Phillips, we're glad to have you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'm Brant Phillips. I'm here today on behalf of the hospital. We urge you to reverse the trial court opinion below, decision below, and I should say I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Two?
At a minimum, we ask the court to reverse the trial court's decision on quantum merit, which is not supported by the record. More importantly, we ask you to reject entirely the trial court's equally flawed determination that no contract existed between the parties due to a lack of mutual assent. In setting that error aside, the court should render or remand with instructions to award damages consistent with the demand the hospital made below.
But what about the unaddressed affirmative defenses?
We would submit, Your Honor, that those have been abandoned at this point. They were not rendered or decided by the trial court below. They were not preserved as a part of the judgment order. They were not appealed. So we do not think those issues remain for decision. The facts underlying this dispute are straightforward. I'll address them quickly. In late May 2014, Mr. Dennis experienced chest pains again while working as a bank loan officer, a job he's done for the past 25 years. He went to a local urgent care facility, which transferred him to our hospital. Like all patients, upon his arrival, he was examined to assess his condition and determine if he needed any form of immediate care or treatment. He did not. The ER staff determined...
Counsel, may I return to the question that Justice Kelsey just asked? As I understood it, he said, what about the unaddressed defenses? And you said they were not preserved, they were not appealed. One of the defenses was lack of capacity, and I think both sides recognized that the trial court didn't address that. It seems the trial court may have ruled on some theory of an adhesion contract, that the contract lacked terms. If we disagree with the trial court, is it your position that we do not send it back for the court to adjudicate lack of capacity, the defense that was raised below?
Correct, Your Honor. We don't think that issue exists for you to decide. And to the extent that the court may disagree with me on that, we think there's ample evidence to allow you to render a decision on that here without having to reweigh.
But let's think this through. Dennis is the appellee. Dennis is not the appellant. Dennis won below. You don't appeal something you win. You only appeal something you win if you want to change the nature of the win.
That would be my response, though, Justice Kelsey, is that he didn't win on capacity below. That issue has not been...
No, I mean, he won a judgment. He was the prevailing party below. And if you're not seeking to upset a judgment, it doesn't matter that there are other grounds that could support it that may or may not exist. You don't have to appeal something if you're not seeking to upset the judgment. Let me restate this. You don't appeal arguments. You don't appeal theories. You don't appeal even rulings so much. You appeal judgments. Your assignments of error get into the nature of the rulings. But the duty to appeal is to appeal a judgment. So if the judgment is satisfactory to the appellee, why is there any duty to appeal the failure to have won the same judgment under a different theory?
Well, I would submit that, that to the extent that had not been decided by the trial court, it should have been preserved as part of the judgment order, and wasn't.
And thus, preserved.
That the case was dismissed in its entirety by the judgment order. So that's what drives my view that it doesn't.
But he wasn't aggrieved by the judgment order. That's a sort of summary statement. For Justice Kelsey and Justice Power saying he was not aggrieved. And if you're not aggrieved, you don't have anything to appeal.
Well, again, in our view, that is not an issue that remains for decision.
Well, that's a tough position to take, but you may continue.
As I mentioned, Mr. Dennis was determined to be in stable condition. He was found to have some arterial blockages that required treatment. He was kept overnight in the hospital, and a surgery was performed to install several stents to clear those blockages. Importantly, when he arrived at the emergency room,
Five stents, is that correct?
Five stents.
Five separate blockages.
Yes, sir. Which were in addition to three he had received some years earlier. It is undisputed that he signed the financial responsibility agreement with the hospital, which is some standard paperwork that all patients are expected to sign. He did that in the presence of his wife, and neither he nor his wife ever expressed any question or concern at the time about being asked to do that.
Might he have had something else on his mind at the time?
Well,
sorry, that, you know, that's a rhetorical question. I think we know the facts, and he was lying on his back having a heart episode in the hospital when he was asked to sign this. Didn't really have the opportunity to do a little value shopping, did he?
Well, we would submit that the fact that this dispute takes place in the context of healthcare doesn't change the analysis. This court has been very clear for the past 60 years that in the absence of mistake, fraud, duress, that the evidence of a signature of a contract is sufficient to establish mutual assent.
Or incapacity. I mean, in fact, the thing that I'm having struggles with is your objective test, which I believe, candidly, you're exactly right in terms of manifestation of intent. That has been the traditional view. And that determines whether or not there is a prima facie meeting of the minds. And it shifts the burden to the opposing party to challenge on an affirmative defense lack of capacity, which is purely subjective. So if you win your first point, which is the objective manifestations were clearly sufficient to show the prima facie contractual intent, and therefore we get to affirmative defense, it needs to be resolved on that the issue of incapacity. I don't understand why that's not the clear route for this case.
Well, again, we believe that because the issue of incapacity is something that has to be decided by clear and convincing evidence, and that the record before this court establishes that there isn't clear and convincing evidence of incapacity. The testimony is very clear that Mr. Dennis did not require assistance in reading or signing the documents that were provided to him. His wife testified unequivocally that she didn't think he needed assistance in reading or signing the documents.
For the sake of argument, an appellate court, appellate judge would agree with you. And if I were hearing this evidence, maybe I'd say that's true. That's not really incapacity. The question is, could a rational fact finder find incapacity? Or stated differently, could this trial court or this jury or whomever decides the case on remand, could they both come to the conclusion reasonably that clear and convincing evidence exists?
We don't believe so on the basis of this record, Your Honor.
Could I ask you about the fact that this lengthy list of prices for the services, et cetera, is essentially unavailable to the folks who want to avail themselves of this service? I mean, if the terms of the contract have to be sufficiently definite and there's no access to what the terms of those contracts are, doesn't that create a problem? Because the terms of the contract have to have some definiteness to them.
We believe they do in this case, Your Honor.
That's the quirk of this case, is that, I mean, they're there, so it's not just nobody knows what they are. It's just that the consumer, seemingly, unless they have to get a court order to disclose them, has no access to them.
We would disagree with that.
Okay.
The evidence here is very clear that Mr. Dennis had access to the items of the charge description master that were relevant to his care in the ordinary course when they were provided to him as part of his bill.
But not before the signature was obtained on the bottom of the paper.
Well, you're saying he knows how much it is when the hospital tells him.
And the cases that we've cited to the court make clear that that is not a rational way to look at this type of transaction.
I mean, were any of those cases, did they deal with an unavailable list like that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. You look at the Woodruff case. Which comes out of Tennessee. In that case, the court made very clear that mere reference to regular rates and terms that the hospital charges for care was sufficient to establish.
Right. No, I understand. I don't have a problem with that concept. My problem is where someone asked to see them, and then they're said, no, you can't. And then you're sitting in the hospital, and you think, well, maybe I should have, you know, if they're going to charge me $50 for an aspirin, maybe I'll have my wife bring me some, or they want to keep me an extra day. Well, if they're going to charge me X, maybe I'll go home. If they don't have access to those things, it's hard for them to know how to behave.
Well, it's important to be clear, though, that Mr. Dennis never asked to see the price list at the time. In fact, he testified repeatedly that he just wanted to get on with it. And perhaps,
yeah.
But nonetheless, the case law that we cited to you makes it very clear that it's not practical in the healthcare context to expect patients or healthcare providers to go over an extensive price list like the one here. It's nearly 200 pages long in any detail in advance of care. And you can imagine the problems that would be caused if we asked a patient to initial every page before getting care.
You were just hitting the nail on the head when you said it's not practical in the healthcare context. The reason why we're here and that you're facing all these questions is because it's the healthcare context, and there was a man lying on his back having a heart attack who had no choice but to sign this document. And that's why we're struggling. There's an ancient Latin maxim called, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And you're here arguing, well, we have to insist upon the very strict contract doctrine in terms of that signature and his assent at the front end, but we're not even going to make available to him the price list if he had asked for it at the time. And there's a disconnect between in your argument there, and it might be you wind up prevailing, but it is quite frustrating for the average consumer, and it's quite frustrating for the court to have to deal with saying, well, you know, we're going to hold him to the strict terms of a contract that even if he had asked to know those terms at the time, you would not have told him.
I don't know that the record establishes that. The record establishes that he didn't ask for them. So I don't think the court can make...
You've just indicated he would have been able to get them in the... I mean, it's a concession on your part. He could not have gotten the prices at the time.
Well, and
he would have gotten it at the time of billing, not at the time of his signature. That's what? The Chief Justice's question.
Well, and the issue, the reason for that is because the nature of the care could vary widely. It may be that Mr. Dennis would have required only an aspirin and could have been released that afternoon. In this case, he required something far more complex that took 3 days of health care. So I'm not sure
worse than that for the doctors and for the hospital. You don't know what you're going to have to do. That's one of the reasons why you can't tell him. You have no idea.
Precisely.
So it's a conundrum of the highest order. A guy is potentially dying on a gurney, signing a contract to pay for services that even you don't know are going to be rendered.
Well,
and who now has already paid more for these services than many, many other people who are either Medicaid, Medicare, or, to my surprise, Anthem subscribers.
Well, let me turn to that, if I may. We think that the trial court got it very wrong in trying to equate the reasonable value of the services that Mr. Dennis received with those other comparators that you just mentioned. As I think the record makes very clear, all of those examples are the product of advanced negotiation as well as separate contracts to establish the discounts to which those persons are entitled. You know, here there was
what
no
about
evidence
the quick,
of that.
What about the quick pay patient, the one who's not insured at all? But
well, I think the record may be a little confused about that because what that situation involves is where an uninsured patient comes in and prepays for the care, as opposed to just promptly paying.
How can they do that if they don't know how much it's going to be? Just give you guys a bunch of money and say, take it off my tab?
Well, we arrange it through consultation with the physician and where it's possible in an advanced situation. We don't have that occur in an uninsured case in emergency situations very often.
I don't know that that's the record before us. As I saw it, I thought it was that you could actually negotiate that afterwards as long as you agreed, as long as... Once you were given the bill, you paid it in a very prompt manner.
The testimony, though, goes to it discusses it in the context of prepayment. But in any event, what you're describing, though, is a situation where the trial court here awarded Mr. Dennis the benefit of a bargain that neither he nor his insurance company made with the hospital, and we don't think that's a fair way to do it. I'm going to reserve the balance of my
time. All right.
May it please the court. My name is James Haskins, and I represent Mr. Dennis in this case. Judge, I think it would be helpful, maybe to me more so than the court, but this case was tried before Judge Williams, who is the chief judge of our Henry County Martinsville Circuit, and notwithstanding what the hospital has said about him, I think he's a very distinguished judge. I do want to say that. Now,
well, I didn't take anything that he said to be disparaging,
yes,
about the judge.
The facts of this case, as found by Judge Williams, which it's my understanding of the law that count one of the hospital's argument about the validity of the FRA contract signed by Mr. Dennis will be decided by this court de novo. This court will accept and give deference to Judge Williams' findings of fact unless the court finds that they are not supported by the evidence. And
but it's not really that simple, and that's the worry that I have is your case has strong emotive themes, but there are legal doctrines which have to be consistent across all industries, all contractual fields. And the first legal doctrine is that the assent to the contract is an objective standard. It's not subjective. In fact, that's the very fulcrum between an affirmative defense challenging a contract and the burden of proof on the party proponent of the contract. So you have an objective standard. If this trial judge appeared to use what I would argue to be a subjective standard on the wrong question. If duress had been in front of the court, or if he had decided incapacity, or for that matter, arguably, if he had even gotten to unconscionability, the subjective factors might have been more relevant. So why isn't the right answer under your best case scenario that it goes back down for an evidentiary hearing on the two affirmative defenses that were pled, incapacity and unconscionability?
If Your Honor, please, an answer. I think the answer to that question is in this court's decision in the Phillips versus Macy case. I think it was a decision written by Justice Kinsler. And she goes through this very point that you're raising, that to have a valid contract, it is crucial to a determination that a contract exists, that the minds of the parties have met on every material phase of the alleged agreement. Now, one thing that's really not been mentioned, which I consider, from our point of view, sir, to be critical, is interrogatory number 17. This is an answer from the hospital. And it goes to the question of the charge master. The hospital is the one that drafted this contract, submitted it to Mr. Dennis in his condition, as you know what Judge Williams found it. I won't go over that again. Now, we filed this interrogatory number 17. It's contained on page 824 of the appendix. And we asked three questions for 2014, which is the year of this event. Mr. Dennis and the hospital, May 29th, 2014. Number one, what are your total receipts for 2014 from charge master prices? Not really receipts, but what are the total charges you make? Number two, what are your total receipts from the charges? And number three, the third part of the interrogatory, sir, was what part of the hospital patients actually pay charge master charges? The hospital's sworn answer by their CEO, Mr. Bement, was that the total charge master charges to all patients for all services of any type for 2014 was approximately $418 million. Number two, the total receipts from the hospital to the hospital from all sources, Medicare, Medicaid.
Counsel, those interrogatory answers seem to perhaps go to your quantum merit theory. How do they address the issue of mutual assent?
Mutual assent?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Judge, could I just, I think
yes,
this
sir.
Will answer it. From my point of view, at least it's the best answer I can give you, ma'am. The total receipts were approximately $100 million. Now we've got $418 million charges, $100 million receipts, and the third element that Mr. Dennis falls into, as far as mutual assent also, Judge, the total receipts from patients, self-pay patients, who actually paid charge master charges, which they are holding Mr. Dennis to, $111,000 bill, the total receipts were
$47,523.
Yes.
He would have been about 20% of the annual total if he paid.
Well, Judge, really, as our expert said, who testified, Mr. Greg Beyer, very respected expert for his working with Novant Health Systems, the hospital charges $418 million, they receive $100. Already, they're accepting 25% from all sources.
Did Mr. Dennis know this when he put his signature on the document?
Sir?
Did Mr. Dennis know all of this?
No, sir. He knew
that. How can it go to the question of whether there was a mutual assent in the creation of an express contract? It seems to me that Justice Powell's question is absolutely on point. That may be relevant to quantum merit, but it's not relevant to mutual assent to contract.
Judge, if Mr. Dennis knew, sir, if the charge master was disclosed these figures to him, if he knew he was being asked to pay what 0.1% of hospital patients pay, how that would go to mutual assent. They would not disclose any information to him.
Well, that's after the fact. I mean, Justice Mintz laid out the scenario. He's on his back on a gurney. He's having a heart attack. No one would reasonably expect him to say, show me all your price lists. It just doesn't work that way. And the hospital doesn't know what they're going to be doing with him, because they've got a critical patient they're about ready to render significant services to, but they just don't know yet how significant. So the whole scenario of, well, here's a master list, here's what this costs, here's what that costs, it seems to me is unrealistic to determine whether a contract has been reached in terms of specific prices. It may be realistic in terms of somebody's assent to put themselves in the circumstances where others are making the decision what kind of services to render. Now, that may very well be relevant for that. But all of the things you're talking about, he had no idea what those things were about.
He had no idea, sir, and nobody told him. The clerk they sent in, Miss Virginia Ramsey, with the phone, she had never heard of the charge master, never discussed anything.
Can I ask you a question? What difference does that make concerning mutual assent? I mean, is it your position that if he knew how much it cost, he wouldn't have asked for the services?
Well, Judge, as I said, in your case, sir, in 2007, Phillips v. Macy, it's crucial as far as the meeting of the minds, mutual assent, that the minds of the party have met on every material phase.
But it can't be the way it works. I mean, it seems like to me, given your example, you're saying, so if I go to the movie theater and I buy a bucket of popcorn, but I find out I paid $8, but it really only cost him 8 cents, I can get a refund, because there was no meeting of the minds. I had no idea they only paid 8 cents for this popcorn. And I paid $8. Yeah, so I mean, I don't understand that.
Well, Judge, if everybody that got the bucket of popcorn paid 8 cents, and you had to pay $8.
But I really wanted the popcorn, and I knew what the price was, and I bought it.
I think that is a critical piece of information under your Phillips v. Macy case that you needed to know before you, to use your example, sir, before you purchased the popcorn for $8 a box when everybody else in the theater bought it for 8 cents.
Hey, now you say, I want some popcorn.
Well, the problem with your argument to me, though, is it, we're mixing a lot of contractual doctrines without even acknowledging it. Mutual assent is not a question of anything related to mistake of fact or mistake of law. Those are affirmative defenses. Mutual assent is the objective manifestation. That's all it is. And that is the starting point. The burden of proof is on the proponent. Everything subjective comes in and populates the list of affirmative defenses. So, if you alluded to a second ago, well, the price is what we agreed to. But you can agree in common law, and there's a battery of cases saying this, to a price reference. You can agree in advance. So I don't know what the price is going to be for this bridge, but whatever the engineering firm charges their regular customers, I'll do that, or whatever. And even if there's no subjective knowledge of it, that satisfies the price function. And, of course, we know under UCC and commercial transactions, you don't even need that. So it would be very helpful to me if you made arguments that were confined to doctrinal points so that we can apply the law carefully to your case as we try to every case.
Your Honor, please, I think under the Phillips case and under the Lucy v. Seema case that's cited throughout the briefs, if all it amounted to, sir, not considering the circumstances that a party finds himself in, which I consider, and I think this court has held, is a critical consideration. See, the hospital is arguing the only thing that makes any difference is a signature, a scrawl signature.
No, they're not. They're not only arguing that. The gentleman testified that he agreed to it and he wanted to get on with it. He wanted the service to be provided. No one put a gun to his head. Circumstances may have put a gun to his head, but the hospital did not.
Judge, the trial court found, and the trial court was the finder of facts, that Mr. Dennis, when he came in to the hospital from the urgent care by ambulance, that he was crucially and acutely in physical and mental distress. The court found...
Distress or duress?
Distress.
Why isn't that just a synonym for duress, which was not pled?
Yeah, duress has got nothing to do with this case. I mean, legal and actionable duress, as defined in the decisions of this court, means a wrongful act that one party perpetrates on the other, Mr. Dennis, that overpowers his will and forces him, basically coerces, as this court said, a signature.
And that sounds like most of your argument.
It certainly wasn't pled because there's no evidence. Judge Williams never mentions it. Zero evidence. He was in, as the court, trial court, on page 2 of the decision, he was in distress. Not only the court found from his wife's testimony, he could not read, he could not concentrate, he was illogical, he was agitated, he was laying there thinking he was going to die. I would respectfully submit to Your Honor that someone in that condition cannot rationally, under any of your court's decisions, mutually assent and make a valid contract.
But doesn't that go to your affirmative defense?
Yeah, I was going to say that's capacity, right?
Sir?
That's capacity. It's not mutual mistake. It's capacity. What you're saying is he didn't have the capacity to make a contract. Is that correct?
Very thin line, Judge, I think, sir, between capacity and mutual assent. And Judge Williams, the way this case was tried, all of the hospital's evidence,
however... Can I tell you where there's the difference is? You can have a lack of mutual assent by mistake. But if you don't have capacity, you can't have a contract at all. So it's not that thin a line.
Well, it's Judge Williams found that someone in this position of Mr. Dennis's condition, as the court knows, all of the things I've just outlined from illogical, that you cannot have with absolute refusal at all points to disclose the price list of mutual assent. And this was true in Lucy B. Sinda. The signature on the back of a napkin was not enough.
Elizabeth?
Let's assume we disagree with you on mutual assent, but we agree that it should be remanded for lack of capacity and unconscionability. Is there any need to take new evidence, or is it just a matter of remanding it for the trial court to make a decision on the evidence that's before it?
Well, ma'am, Judge Williams, as I said, the way the case was tried, he heard all of that evidence.
That's
and never made any rulings. We left his courtroom that day with no rulings. He's heard it all, yes, on unconscionability, capacity, all of it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for your argument.
Thank you, sir.
Just very quickly, Your Honors. First, just to speak very quickly to the idea of meeting of the minds. You know, as we've noted in the Spring Lake case, that concept has been replaced by mutual assent, which is more objective and has been made more objective to deal with the conundrums that you raised, Justice Lemons. I also want to say just very quickly, we're sympathetic to the concerns about the way health care gets paid for in this country that clearly seem to have animated the trial court's decision. As we all know, there's a robust debate about that going on at the state and federal level. Respectfully, though, I would submit that's where it belongs. Not here in the trial courts of Virginia. The trial court's well-meaning but badly misguided decision has fundamentally undermined the precedents that have governed contract formation and defenses in this state for decades. Mutual assent is not and should not become a catch-all that gives a patient an out when it's here they can't prove an affirmative defense. This court concluded that long ago.
Did you hear Justice McClanahan's question, her last question?
I did, yes,
would
sir.
Would you answer that one as well?
Yes. If it were to go back, we would submit there's no need to take additional evidence, which I think was your question.
Yes, thank you.
All right, well, your time has expired. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Call the next case.